BBC World Service, welcome to World Briefing with Julie Candler. The headlines at 9 o'clock, Greenwich Mean Time. European Union fisheries ministers have announced drastic cuts in fishing quotas as part of measures to save some species from being fished to extinction. An official ceremony is to take place in a few hours' time to close for good the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, the scene of the world's worst nuclear accident. And the United States President-elect, George W. Bush, has indicated that his administration will address the issue of electoral reform. We'll have all those stories in full, plus British Airways says it hopes to put its fleet of Concorde airliners back into service early next year. And scientists say they've more evidence of life on Mars. This is the BBC in London. But first, a roundup of the world news.
BBC News with Gaynor Howells. European Union fisheries ministers have agreed at talks in Brussels to make big cuts in North Sea fishing quotas for next year. They say the cuts are the first in a series of measures that are needed to protect rapidly dwindling stocks of common species. Here's Janet Barry.
The deal emerged after 12 hours of talks. Fishermen's leaders described it as an appalling outcome. But the ministers backed down from supporting the biggest cuts in quotas proposed by the European Commission. The quotas for cod caught in the North Sea will fall by over 40%. But fishermen will be allowed to catch far more hake, whiting and haddock than the Commission had recommended. Fishermen's group said the compromise wouldn't be enough to save jobs and help ailing fishing communities. Europe's fisheries ministers have been under more pressure than ever before at this year's round of talks. Scientists have warned that some fish, including North Sea cod, are at risk of being fished to extinction, and drastic measures are needed if they're ever to recover.
The Chernobyl nuclear power plant in Ukraine is to be shut down forever today. Nearly 15 years ago, it was the scene of the world's worst ever nuclear accident. Paul Anderson reports from Kiev.
The Ukrainian president, Leonid Kuchma, will give the order to switch off Chernobyl's only functioning reactor after a church service in Kiev to remember all those who died in the nuclear disaster. 31 people, mostly firemen, were killed immediately after the explosion. Several thousand more, those involved in the cleanup and children, have since died from radiation-related illnesses. The blast occurred as engineers were testing safety systems. The force was so great it blew the 2,000-ton steel lid off its reactor and sent a cloud of radioactive particles across the region and northwest Europe. Ukraine drove a hard bargain before agreeing to close the plant. $2.5 billion for help in meeting decommissioning costs, another $750 million to build a new housing over the stricken reactor, and more than $200 million to fund the completion of two new plants.
The European Court of Human Rights is expected to announce its decision later on Friday whether to proceed with a case of the Kurdish rebel leader Abdullah Öcalan, who has appealed against a death sentence imposed by a Turkish court. The court had asked Turkey to postpone his execution until it reaches a decision, a call which Turkey accepted. Mr. Öcalan, who is widely blamed in Turkey for the deaths of thousands of people during 16 years of armed conflict, has been kept in a special prison in Turkey following his capture in Africa last year. You're listening to the news from the BBC. After the lengthy dispute over the result of the American presidential election, the incoming team of the president-elect, George W. Bush, has signalled that it will address the issue of reforming the voting system. Mr. Bush's brother, Jeb, who's the governor of Florida, has set up a commission to examine the equipment used in the state to count votes. The machines are estimated to have produced one spoiled ballot in every 100. And in a separate development, George W. Bush himself has agreed to discuss the issue of election reform, following allegations that black voters were unfairly treated in some areas of Florida. British Airways says it hopes to put seven Concordes back into service by next April. The aircraft were grounded after the Paris air disaster in July, which claimed the lives of 113 people. Engineers from France and Britain will reveal design changes today. Here's our transport correspondent, Simon Montague.
There's growing confidence that Concorde will fly again. British Airways has put together a programme of modification work, which could lead to Concorde being back in service by late March or early April. today's Anglo-French meeting will hear news of the investigators' latest findings. They already know the crash near Paris last July was caused by a piece of metal on the runway which burst a tyre and punctured the fuel tanks. They now have two possibilities as to how the fuel leak caught fire. Either a spark from damaged electrical wiring in the undercarriage bay or hot gases coming from the front of the engines. The main safety modifications will consist of a Kevlar and rubber lining inside the fuel tanks and a new reinforced wiring system under the wings.
Members of the Spanish basketball team at this year's Paralympic Games in Sydney are to hand back the gold medals they won after 10 of the players were found to have no disability. The Spanish Paralympic Committee said its investigation had also uncovered irregularities in other sports. It said it was continuing investigations to determine the eligibility of three other athletes, two of whom were medalists. BBC News.
It's 9:06 GMT. You're listening to the BBC World Service with Julie Candler. Now more on the agreement reached in late-night talks in Brussels to try to conserve threatened stocks of fish in the North Sea. A compromise will allow fishermen to catch larger numbers of certain types than the European Commission originally proposed, but quotas for cod will fall by more than 40%. The EU Commissioner responsible for fisheries, Franz Fischler, said the cuts were the most drastic since quotas were introduced.
If we wouldn't accept such drastic cuts, the consequence would be that the whole sector would be under threat and there wouldn't be any chance that the stocks would recover. So therefore it was necessary to do that, and we hope that with all these measures we should be in a few years in a position so that the stocks are again there and that the fishermen can continue with their fishing activities.
Conservationists support the cuts but say quota reductions alone will not solve the long-term problem. The World Wildlife Fund's marine policy officer in Britain, Sarah Jones, argues that massive financial help is needed to save both the industry and the fish.
We've been running down a resource for all this time, living off capital, not interest, as far as the fish stocks are concerned. And now we find ourselves in a crisis and we've got to do something about it. What we've got to recognise is the quotas are not the only conservation measure. There's a whole package of measures that need to be put in place, both to save the fish stocks and to save the security of the fishing industry.
Many fishermen accept the need for controls, but Hamish Morrison of the Scottish Fishermen's Federation says the measures will have a dire effect on fishing communities.
These cuts would certainly result in the loss of livelihood for several hundreds of people. Probably in extreme case, we'd have to start decommissioning boats, and the knock-on effect in the fishing communities would be catastrophic.
Hamish Morrison representing Scottish fishermen. The ceremony to switch off the last reactor at Chernobyl comes 14 and a half years after the world's worst nuclear accident, which sent a radioactive cloud across Europe. The environmental pressure group Greenpeace is calling for other similar facilities to be closed in the former Soviet Union. The reactor has been plagued by problems in recent weeks and has been shut down on a number of occasions. The European Bank for Reconstruction and Development has spearheaded efforts to close Chernobyl. Its vice president, Joachim Janka, says he's relieved the plant is to be shut down.
I'm extremely happy because I've been attached to the problems for so many years, and it's really time to have it closed. It was a very dangerous plant, and it still operated in a state that it should probably not have done so. So one should be happy, everybody should be happy that this is now closed.
Joachim Janka. But even though the Chernobyl plant is being closed down, the health problems attributed to the disaster linger on. Scientists are still undecided over just how extreme those problems are. It's not just in Ukraine, but in its neighbours like Belarus that the tragic consequences are still being felt. There, the one indisputable effect has been the increase of one particular form of cancer, as Robin Aitken reports.
The only proven link so far is to thyroid cancer. It was extremely rare before the accident. Then doctors in Belarus, the Ukraine and Russia began noticing a sharp increase. Specialists in the West at first rejected the notion. But as Professor Sir Dilwyn Williams, who heads the Cambridge Thyroid Cancer Group in Britain, explains, Western predictions were wrong.
At the beginning, those who were concerned with the nuclear industry were very very suspicious that the reports were being exaggerated for financial gain by the three countries involved, particularly the two countries mostly involved, Belarus and Ukraine. In fact, that has not turned out to be true. The diagnoses of cancer were, in fact, pretty accurate by Western standards.
Opinion amongst Western experts remains sceptical, though. A UN report published earlier this year said there was no reason for people living in areas contaminated by radioactive fallout to fear the consequences. But that isn't accepted locally. A study published in Belarus this autumn said there had been 26,000 radiation-induced cancers in the country since the disaster, leading to 11,000 deaths. The link between Chernobyl and ill health may lie in the food chain. Food grown or gathered on contaminated land contains low-level radioactivity, which some experts believe is a major threat to health. Professor Vasily Nestorenko is a nuclear physicist who now devotes himself to the health consequences of Chernobyl in Belarus.
So preconditions for cancer have been created, and now the floodgates have opened. First it was thyroid cancer, now it is breast cancer amongst women, and next we see cancer of the digestive tract in children, then kidneys, and many instances of diabetes in children.
The Strangeways Laboratory in Cambridge was chosen to coordinate research into the Chernobyl thyroid cancer epidemic. Well over 1,000 cases have now been identified, a 100-fold increase in the normal incidence. Scientists remain professionally cautious about other health effects, but they're not ruling anything out. The West has proved reluctant to accept the claims of doctors and scientists in the affected countries that Chernobyl has caused a big increase in a range of cancers. The problem is that, scientifically speaking, proving cause and effect is very difficult. There are too many other factors, the skeptics argue, that might be affecting health. What's more, there is no coordinated research taking place, which could finally resolve the argument.
That report by Robin Aitken. Talks between NATO foreign ministers are going into a second day, with discussions over cooperation between NATO and the European Union stalled over demands by Turkey for greater influence in decision-making. Turkey, which is in NATO but not the EU, insists that it should take part in the European Union's defence decisions that affect its strategic interests. The Turkish delegation at Brussels has been told that if they persevere in their demands, they risk holding up the vital talks on the mechanics of the EU-NATO relationship. The French president, Jacques Chirac, has denied knowledge of an illegal fundraising scheme which was alleged to have been run by his party while he was mayor of Paris. In an interview on French television, Mr. Chirac said he wouldn't give evidence about it in court. The interview followed growing calls for the president to explain himself. Here's our Paris correspondent, James Kumarasamy.
During the hour-long interview, Jacques Chirac was at his most presidential. He firmly denied any knowledge of the alleged kickback scam, which one French newspaper has called the biggest political scandal of the Fifth Republic. The charges date back to the time when Mr. Chirac was mayor of Paris. His RPR party is said to have used construction contracts to organise the illegal funding of several political parties. Not only did Mr. Chirac say that he'd been unaware of the funding details, but that he didn't believe an organised kickback scheme had existed. There have been growing calls for the president to make a public statement about the allegations, since leaked details from court cases suggested he was at the centre of the scam. But a combative Mr. Chirac said he would refuse to testify if he was called as a witness in the case for constitutional reasons. He rounded on the media for creating what he said was a dangerous situation by reporting decade-old events as if they were new. France, he said, was not a society where corruption reigns. Observers say that while Mr. Chirac's performance was impressive, it lacked the frankness that his enemies and some of his allies had been calling for. It's unlikely to convince the French public that their leader is beyond reproach.
James Kumarasamy in Paris. An Israeli delegation, including the foreign minister Shlomo Ben-Ami, has met the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat to discuss how to rescue the Middle East peace process. Security is being stepped up in Jerusalem for Friday prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. From Jerusalem, here's Paul Wood.
These were talks about talks, part of the continuing effort to re-establish substantive negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians, and the two sides are expected to meet again next week in Egypt. Israeli Army Radio reported that there was, though, one immediate benefit, with both sides agreeing to resume the security cooperation that has dwindled to almost nothing during 11 weeks of bloodshed. Efforts are now being directed only at reaching a loose framework for a final peace deal, and to do this before special Israeli prime ministerial elections in 2 months' time. Difficult issues such as the final status of Jerusalem and the return of refugees are being put off, perhaps for as long as 3 years. Everything now depends on Yasser Arafat, whether he's prepared to throw the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak a political lifeline by concluding some kind of agreement, or whether he believes that the Palestinians can get more by waiting.
Paul Wood. The deadline for the rival ethnic militias in the Solomon Islands to hand over their weapons to an international monitoring team expires today. It's part of a peace plan brokered by the Australians, aimed at ending 2 years of bloody conflict between rebels from Guadalcanal Island and Malaita Province. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The weapons handover is seen as crucial to the success of the Townsville peace agreement, which was signed in October. The Solomon Islands Peace Monitoring Council has made a final appeal to both sides to surrender their guns ahead of the deadline. Those who don't may not qualify for the weapons amnesty and could face arrest and prosecution. Under the deal, unarmed peacekeepers from Australia and New Zealand have been deployed to supervise the decommissioning. It's not clear how many firearms have been handed over to the Australian-led monitoring team so far. Andrew Norrie, a spokesman for the Malaita Eagle Force, the MEF, says 90% of its guns were now in the hands of designated commanders or have been returned to the police. 2 years of fighting over jobs and land between the Isatabu Freedom Movement, who are natives of the main island of Guadalcanal, and the MEF, who are migrants from the neighbouring island of Malaita, has left more than 100 people dead and thousands homeless.
Phil Mercer in Sydney. A human rights report on the Democratic Republic of Congo has warned of an increasingly desperate situation for the population living in the east of the country. The report by the London-based organisation African Rights provides detailed accounts of human rights abuses by a number of different armed groups in eastern Congo and calls on all parties involved in the fighting to honour their commitments to peace. Chris Simpson reports from Kampala.
The African Rights report provides a damning overview of human rights abuses in eastern Congo. It concludes that life for most of the population living in the eastern provinces of North and South Kivu is governed by hunger, disease, and a reign of terror imposed by different armed groups. The report calls on all parties involved in the conflict to stop fighting and urges the United Nations to take a more purposeful approach, focusing on the need for economic regeneration and social reconstruction in a region which is fast falling apart. But it also acknowledges that past appeals have been in vain and the war is simply too complicated and too entrenched for any easy resolution. Much of eastern Congo is nominally held by the Congolese Rally for Democracy, or RCD, a rebel movement which is committed to the removal of Congolese President Laurent Kabila. According to African Rights, the RCD is massively resented by much of the population, partly for its record of incompetence and poor leadership, but mainly because it is seen as a front organisation for the Rwandan government.
Chris Simpson in Kampala. You're listening to the BBC in London. Today's main news. Europe's fishermen are told they'll have to further limit their catches or fish stocks will become exhausted. President Leonid Kuchma of Ukraine is to throw a switch shortly that will shut down the last reactor at Chernobyl. And the American president-elect George W. Bush has begun preparing to move into the White House next month. As well as deciding on who will make up his administration, Mr. Bush has been discussing security arrangements with Secret Service agents. Our correspondent in Austin, Texas, Rob Watson, has been looking at how the Bush presidency is likely to operate.
During the post-election mess, George W. Bush was rarely seen or heard. Most of the talking was left to his running mate Dick Cheney and his senior legal advisor James Baker, both of whom had served his father, the former President Bush. It had many saying the younger Bush was largely a figurehead of his own campaign, the real power lying elsewhere. Not surprisingly, Mr. Bush's aides paint a somewhat different picture. They insist it was always George W. Bush calling the shots, and that it's only natural that he should turn to those trusted by his father in his time of need. But neither the president-elect nor his officials make any secret that he's no great fan of the details of day-to-day governing or policy-making. George W. Bush has described himself as being no fine tuner, preferring to leave the implementation of policy to trusted aides. It's a style that some analysts say raises questions about whether the advisers, rather than the president-elect, will really be in charge of a Bush administration. Mr. Bush himself dismisses such suggestions and has often said that similar accusations were made about Ronald Reagan, a man he describes as one of America's greatest presidents.
Meanwhile, there's intense speculation in Washington about who will get the top jobs in the Bush administration. The expected choice for Secretary of State in charge of foreign policy is Colin Powell, who was the senior U.S. military commander during the Gulf War. Richard Pearl, a key advisor to Mr. Bush, had high praise for Mr. Powell.
Well, he's a man of very great experience, obviously both in military matters and national security generally. He moves easily among heads of state and diplomats and military men. I think he'll do a superb job as Secretary of State.
Mr. Powell also said he believed Washington would carry out a thorough review of its relationship with Europe in NATO in view of the European Union's growing involvement in military issues. We asked Mr. Pearl whether President Bush would expect Europe to take more responsibility for its own defense.
It would be highly desirable for Europe to take more responsibility. What we have seen up until now, however, is not an assumption of responsibility, but rather the establishment of a parallel decision process without any increased responsibility and certainly without any increased real military capability. And this has caused significant misgivings among a number of people around the president-elect. What conclusion he will come to, I certainly can't say now, but I'm sure he'll want to take a close look at this.
Richard Pearl, a senior advisor to George W. Bush. A former member of the Japanese guerrilla group, the Red Army Faction, has apologized for his role in the hijack of an airliner to North Korea in 1970. At his first court appearance since his extradition to Japan, Yoshimi Tanaka pleaded guilty to the charge of hijacking the plane. Four of the hijackers are still living in the North Korean capital Pyongyang with their families. Charles Scanlon reports from Tokyo.
In March 1970, nine members of the Red Army faction seized control of a Japan Airlines Boeing 727 on an internal flight and ordered the pilot to North Korea. It was the opening shot in a campaign of violence by Japanese leftists as the student movement of the 1960s took an even more radical turn. Yoshimi Tanaka and his comrades were granted political asylum in Pyongyang. He's believed to have then worked overseas as a North Korean agent. He was extradited to Japan in June this year after being arrested in Thailand. On his first appearance in court, he said he had no intention of challenging the facts of the case. He said he wanted to apologize to passengers on the flight for what he called their nightmare journey. Yoshimi Tanaka described the hijacking as an outrageous and unjustifiable act, whatever his original motives had been. Four of the Red Army faction members remain in Pyongyang with their families, but the North Korean authorities have been coming under growing diplomatic pressure to extradite them to Japan. Japan has scored a number of recent successes against the former guerrilla movements, which had their heyday in the 1970s. Police last month arrested the leader of the Japanese Red Army, once one of the world's most feared ultra-leftist groups. Fusako Shigenobu had returned to Japan 3 decades after leaving for Lebanon, where she worked closely with radical Palestinian groups.
Charles Scanlon. The president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, the first Russian leader to visit Cuba since the Cold War, has sharply criticized the United States' economic embargo against the island. Mr. Putin and the Cuban president Fidel Castro also denounced what they said were attempts by the Americans to use the issue of human rights to interfere in the affairs of other countries. The Russian leader, the first to visit Havana since the collapse of the Soviet bloc, says he wants to revive cooperation between the former Cold War allies. From Havana, Tom Gibb reports.
After the standard Cuban welcome with brass bands and saluting soldiers, Fidel Castro and President Putin signed a joint declaration. They not only condemned the U.S. economic embargo against Cuba, they also condemned attempts to introduce concepts like humanitarian interference and limited sovereignty in the world, which they said are used to bypass the United Nations. Both leaders afterwards said that President Putin's visit would mark not only a renewal of close bilateral relations, but also the start of closer cooperation in international affairs. The two countries have signed agreements for cooperation in trade, health, finance, and to set up a joint archive. Russia has agreed to give commercial credits to the island. But in real terms, this falls far short of the old Cold War alliance. No one is predicting that Russian investment will come to match that of Cuba's main trading partners in Canada and Western Europe. And the chemistry is different. Where in the past there were kisses and bear hugs between Cuban and Soviet leaders, now there are polite Western-style handshakes.
Tom Gibb in Havana. A Malaysian national has pleaded guilty in a court in San Francisco to being a leading member of a group smuggling rare and endangered animals. The accused, Anson Wong, is to be sentenced in March. He was charged with running a wildlife import-export business, illegally shipping protected reptiles from Malaysia, Indonesia and the Philippines. A man in the United States has been declared insane after he was found guilty of stalking the Oscar-winning actress Gwyneth Paltrow. A secret trial in Los Angeles has heard how he sent sexually graphic letters and left presents outside her parents' home in Los Angeles. From Los Angeles, Peter Bowes reports.
Under California law, Gwyneth Paltrow chose to have her name removed from court documents. The trial of Dante Soyou, who's 49, went ahead last week in Santa Monica without any media attention. The court heard how he'd sent the actress letters and emails, as well as travelling to Los Angeles from his home in Ohio to bring Paltrow gifts. They included flowers, sweets, pizza and pornography. He continued to pursue the actress despite a warning from the FBI. Soyou was found guilty of stalking and declared to be legally insane by the judge. He's been sent to a secure psychiatric facility for an indefinite period.
Peter Bowes in Los Angeles. Shares in the internet group America Online and the media giant Time Warner have risen after the United States authorities approved their planned merger. The deal, valued at more than $100 billion, is said to be the biggest in American corporate history. A team of American scientists who claimed they'd uncovered evidence of life on Mars have published more research to back up their controversial theory. The team from the Texas-based aeronautics firm Lockheed Martin says their new study should go towards answering critics of their original findings in 1996. Here's our science correspondent David Whitehouse.
After their dramatic announcement that they'd found evidence of fossilized life in a rock from Mars, the researchers felt that although many scientists dismissed their claims, they did so out of a reluctance to consider the facts rather than on the basis of the evidence. Now, in what is acknowledged by all as an impressive piece of work, the original researchers have extended their analysis. They found that tiny magnetic grains in the Mars meteorite are identical to similar grains produced by some strains of terrestrial bacteria. The tiny grains, made of a mineral called magnetite, are so small that you could fit a billion of them onto the head of a pin. The researchers say that if you did not know that the rock was from Mars, you would conclude that it definitely contains evidence for past life. Critics will say that claiming life on Mars requires the strongest of evidence to support it, and that this is not it. But what is clear, however, is that claims that Mars once held life cannot be dismissed. Some suggest that the only way to settle the issue is to bring back more Mars rocks for analysis, and that is unlikely for at least a decade to come.
Our science correspondent David Whitehouse. And a reminder of today's main world news, European Union fisheries ministers have agreed at talks in Brussels to make big cuts in fishing quotas for next year. I'm Julie Candler. You're listening to the BBC in London.